Chapter 85. In the event, the big GM diesel gave me a little better than 65 miles an hour, and 2 minutes short of 10 o'clock, I pulled up and hid the truck in the last of the trees and walked the rest of the way. A man on foot can be a lot stealthier than a 4-ton military vehicle, and safety is always the best policy. But there was nothing to hide from. Main Street was quiet. There was nothing to see except light in the diner's window and my borrowed Buick and Devereaux's Caprice parked nose to tail in front of it. I guessed Devereaux was keeping half an eye on the situation, but not worrying too much about it. The senator's presence all but guaranteed a quiet and untypical night. I stayed on the Kellam Road and skipped Main Street itself, and looped around behind it on a wide and cautious radius. I kept myself concealed behind the last row of parked cars and walked down level with Brannan's bar. The crowd at the door was still there. I could see maybe 50 guys clustered in the same semicircle I had seen before. Past them, I could see a big crowd inside the bar itself, some guys standing, and some, I assumed, sitting at the tables further into the room, although I had no direct view of the latter group. I moved closer, squeezing between parked cars and pickup trucks, with the hubbub ahead of me getting a little louder with each step, but not much louder. The noise was a lot lower in level and a lot more polite and restrained than it would have been on any other night. Best behavior. I crossed an open lane between the first row of cars and the second, and eased onward between a 20-year-old Cadillac and a beat-up GMC Jimmy, and a soft voice right next to me said, "Hello, Reacher." I turned and saw Monroe leaning against the far side of the Jimmy, neatly in the shadow, nearly invisible, relaxed and patient and vigilant. "Hello, Monroe," I said. "It's good to see you, although I have to say I didn't expect to." He said, "Likewise." "Did Stan Lowry call you?" He nodded. "But a little too late." "Three guys?" He nodded again. "Mortarmen from the 75th. "Where are they now?" "Tied up with telephone wire, gagged with their own T-shirts, locked in my room." "Good work," I said. Which it was. One against three, no warning, taken by surprise, but a satisfactory result nonetheless. I was impressed. Monroe was nobody's fool. That was clear. He asked, "Who did you get?"
"An anti-aircraft crew."
"Where are they?" "Walking back from halfway to Memphis with no shoes and no pants." He smiled. White teeth in the dark, he said.
"I hope I never get posted to Benning."
I asked, "Is Riley in the bar?"
"First to arrive, with his dad. They're holding court big time. Tab must be $300 by now."
"Curfew's still in place?"
He nodded. "But it's going to be a last-minute rush. You know how it is. The mood turned out to be pretty good, and no one will want to be the first to leave."
"Okay," I said. "Your job is to make sure Riley is the last to leave. I need him to be the very last car out of here, and not by a second or two either, by a minute at least. Do whatever it takes to make that happen, will you? I'm depending on it." With anyone else, I might then have gone ahead and sketched out a few alternative ways to accomplish that goal, like suggestions, anything from puncturing a tire to asking for the old guy's autograph. But by then I was beginning to realize Monroe didn't need help. He would think of all the same things I could, and maybe a few more besides. He said,
"Understood."
"And then your job is to go sit on Elizabeth Devereaux. I need her to be under your eye throughout, in the diner or wherever. Again, whatever it takes."
"Understood," he said again. "She's in the diner right now, as it happens."
"Keep her there," I said. "Don't let her go out on traffic patrol tonight.
Tell her with the senator behind them, the guys will behave.
She knows that. She gave her deputies the night off.
Good to know, I said. And good luck. And thanks.
I squeezed back between the Cadillac and the Jimmy and crossed the open lane and threaded through the rearmost rank of cars and walked out of the lot the same way I had come in. 5 minutes later, I was just past the railroad crossing, hidden in the trees on the side of the road that led to Kellam, waiting again. Monroe's assessment of the collective mood turned out to be correct. No one left as early as 10:30 because of the weird dynamics surrounding the senator. I had seen similar things before. I was pretty sure no one from Bravo Company would have pissed on the guy if he was on fire, but everyone seemed fascinated by his alien presence, and no doubt everyone still had the base commander's instructions ringing in his ears. Be nice to the VIP. Show him some respect. So no one peeled away early. No one wanted to go first. No one wanted to stand out. So 10:30 came and went with no movement on the road. None at all. As did 10:35, 10:40 likewise. Then at 10:45, the dam broke and they came in droves. I heard noise like a muted version of an armored division firing up, and I saw exhaust smoke and crisscross headlight beams far in the distance as they all started jockeying for position and funneling out of the lot. Lights swung toward me in an endless chain, and 30 seconds later, the lead car thumped over the crossing and sped on by. It was followed by all the others in sequence, too many to count, each just yards from the one in front, like stock cars on a racetrack straightaway. Engines roared and wheezed, and worn tires pattered over the rails, and I smelled the sweet, sharp tang of unleaded gasoline. I saw the old Cadillac and the GMC Sport Utility I had squeezed between, and I saw Chevys and Dodges and Fords and Plymouths and Jeeps and Chryslers, sedans and pickup trucks, and four-wheel drives and coupes and two-seaters. They kept on coming, an unbroken stream, heading home, relieved, exuberant, their duty done. 10 minutes later, the stream was thinning, and the gaps between cars were lengthening, and in the distance I could see late stragglers moving out. The last dozen vehicles took a whole minute to pass me by. None of them was a flat green staff car. The final tail end Charlie was an old Pontiac sedan, scarred and sagging. I watched it approach. As soon as he passes us, I guarantee we're alone in the world, Devereaux had said. Then the old Pontiac thumped quietly over the track on soft tires, and then it was gone. I stepped out of the trees and faced east and saw tiny red taillights disappearing into the darkness. The noise faded behind them, and the exhaust smoke drifted and cleared. I turned the other way, and far in the distance and right on cue, I saw a lone pair of headlights click on. I saw their beams bounce and swing, side to side, up and down, and I saw them lead the way north, out through the lot, and then I saw them swing toward me, and bounced twice more as the wheels behind them climbed up off the dirt and onto the blacktop. The clock in my head showed 1:01. I walked west, back over the railroad crossing, 10 yards toward the town, and then I stopped and stepped out to the crown of the road and raised my hand high, palm out, like a traffic cop.